There was a problem very early on in the 50s when I began to use mass media-oriented subject matter, in that people didn't know quite how to receive these things, whether they were satirical or glorifying the objects represented. And both of these attitudes would come at me rather aggressively. For example, there was the cultural attaché at the American Embassy, who was very interested in art and was involved with all the younger artists of London. I was at that time a young artist. He came to my home one evening and put the question, why do you attack America in this way? Why do you find it necessary to satirize American culture? And I said, I didn't see it as that at all, and had to argue with him for half an hour and try to persuade him that that was the case. On other occasions, I had to argue with people who thought of it as a glorification of American culture. If the slightest stars and stripes appeared in a painting, as opposed to the kind of pop imagery which, for example, Peter Blake was putting out, this was more acceptable to an English public because it was more likely to represent a Union Jack than a star or a stripe. And I also had to fight the idea that we were being situated somewhere in mid-Atlantic, even maybe speaking with a slightly American accent in our normal modes of speech, let alone what we were talking about. And I had equally to fight this attitude of saying that I wasn't the least bit involved with that kind of attitude, but rather that I saw America as a kind of prototype of what we were all to become, that it was inevitable that any industrialized society would go in that direction, and therefore it was sociologically interesting to examine what was going on there rather than to examine what was going on under my nose. And I had also a quite clear-cut theoretical model for this, in that among the things that were being discussed at the Independent group was non-Aristotelian logic. And I was very taken with this idea that you could go about your business without saying whether something was good or bad. And the first pictures that I attempted took this non-Aristotelian stand. Value judgments were regarded as something unnecessary. One could approach subject matter in this amoral way. And so I tried very consciously to avoid these value judgments. And so I was able to satisfy myself when I answered these people by saying, no, it's not glorification, it's not satirical, it's not criticizing anyone, it is non-Aristotelian. I have written a good deal, and it has tended to subvert what critics wrote about me. I've always been rather disappointed that it was very rare that a critic came up with an original thought about what I was doing, that the likelihood is that they would quote from what I had written. Either they would quote it in quotation marks or rephrase it and not use the quotation marks. Another drawback to writing was that people felt that it showed an inadequacy in my abilities as a painter. I remember very well one evening there was a sort of discussion at the Whitechapel, and some of the young contemporary painters exhibiting there were being asked questions. One of them said rather pointedly, I'm in the painting business, not the information business. And I felt that he was looking my way somehow. Maybe it did hit me rather hard that perhaps that was what I ought to be doing, being in the painting business rather than the information business. But it didn't deter me completely. And one of the reasons that I persisted was that writing about my own work did prove very successful, in the sense that it got results in a way that the paintings didn't. I had a show in 1955, which was moderately successful critically, but not from any other point of view. And for the subsequent 8 years, I went practically every 6 months to Hanover Gallery, where I'd had the show, and said, would you like to come up and see my paintings again? And I always got cold shoulder. Nobody was willing to go from Bond Street to Highgate to look at things. And I thought that I'd gone beyond the stage where I walked around the Bond Street galleries with paintings under my arm. And then in 1960, three it must have been, the ICA did the Living Arts magazine. I was asked to write an article, and I did the cover and made a very serious piece of writing. It was really trying to express in written form, in words, what I'd been doing in painting. And I used the same techniques that I'd been using for painting, that is to say, a certain amount of collage, pastiche, and all the other devices that were applicable to painting seemed to be easily converted to the written word. And within a week of that thing being published, I met Erica Brousson in the gallery in Bonkin in Kasmin, and as usual I said, what about coming up to Highgate? And she said, well, I won't bother to come up to Highgate, but I saw that piece in the magazine, and let's fix up a show. And then Robert Fraser, whom I've been trying to persuade to come up, that same evening said, can I come up and talk to you about a show? And I said, I've just committed myself to a show at Hanover. One of the people I admired most as a collector, Ted Power, whom I'd known for 10 years, had a very friendly relationship to him, I met a week or so later, and he said, I'd like to buy one of your pictures. Where can I come up and see you? So he bought a picture. He didn't pay for it for 6 months. I rang him up, and he said, I didn't know you wanted the money. come along this evening. I've got people coming to dinner, but if you come along at 11:30, that will be okay. So I went at 11:30, and he took me into a room, raised the pen and his checkbook, looked me in the eye, and said, I can write a check for £300, which was the price of the picture, or I can write a check for £2,000. If I write a check for £2,000, I would like to have pictures from you at this price, which I will select from you over the years. And alternatively, you can decide to have the money that you're due for that picture. So I said, well, I think I better take the money. I mean, not take the 2,000, but take my 300. Because suddenly I thought it was a bit odd. And I said to him, why are you interested in buying my pictures? I've known you for all these years. You've seen them around. And it's very odd that you should suddenly show this kind of commitment to them. And he said, well, before I saw that article in Living Arts, I didn't know you were serious. And that struck me, that the power of the word is greater than the power of the brush, obviously. And I've always felt that it was useful to be able to get across my seriousness in words in a way that I couldn't in the painting. Somehow people didn't take the painting seriously. They thought they were dilettante. Also, the fact that they're rather spasmodically produced. I tend to take a long time over things. I don't know whether it's laziness or simply that it's rather too difficult for me. I bite off more than I can chew, and I don't get a resolution for a long time. Having written about things in a way that makes people think they're serious and reasoned, I had almost come to the conclusion that perhaps the paintings were reasoned and serious. And it takes a long time before the thought begins to come back that maybe you don't know what you're doing anyway. And now I'm thoroughly convinced that I don't know what I'm doing, and that writing is a way of finding out. Very often the writing occurs after the event or part way through it, and I do find it useful in that it explains to me what I'm doing. Well, it's not like writing a program, although I have done that. Understanding begins to come back to the work from the need to think about it. I find that there are changes that occur in a general sense in what I do, which are totally surprising to me. For example, I started painting a picture of a blanket man in the H block. There was shit all over the place, rather more elaborately than the discreet little elements that were combined with glamour in older pictures that I'd done. I was invited about a year ago to go to Cambridge by Sandy Wilson, who is a professor there, an old friend of mine. The architecture school in Cambridge has always had a tradition of inviting artists. They've always had a contact with artists ever since the ICA days, when architects and painters were rather closer than I think they are at the moment. He asked a lot of people to talk about what they thought to be the difference. So I had to think about the difference between the good old days and the present. And having been required to think about it, I came to the conclusion that there was a vast change that had taken place, and we were all excited by prospects of the post-war years, of the future, the consumer society, when everything was going to be given. I realized that current preoccupations were likely to be much more pessimistic, that there was a completely different mood, certainly in my own attitude to painting. And I began to even pinpoint it. I thought, when did shit first appear in my paintings, combined maybe with fashion models or with flowers? And it turned out to be 1973. So I then thought, 1973 is the petrol crisis. And I'm sure now, having given it a lot of consideration, that the decline in the Western economy is really the reason for my having brought in very, very surreptitiously in the first place, and now dramatically with this H-bomb, the kind of excremental vision which I think psychologists discuss much more easily than art critics. Art critics are liable to pass it off as a sexual aberration of a senile painter, and pop artists are likely to go in peculiar ways. But I've learned from having Freud thrust under my nose that perhaps what I was doing had some psychological significance which I didn't understand at all. It seems to me that a good deal of what an artist does is complete mystery and totally outside his understanding.
I wonder whether a lot of your work is episodic in various ways. Those paintings of the late 50s, the white surface remains continuous in the picture, and then there are episodes within the picture which might belong to different stylistic languages, some of them to a sort of scientific American diagrams. As you yourself, I think, have enumerated the various kinds of ways of representing shine on chrome and so forth. You would use dotted lines, which might indicate movement in a certain kind of advertisement. So the paintings in those days were made up very often of a number of passages of different visual languages. Is this something which you do as a kind of deliberate semiotic?
Yes, it's very deliberate, and I even got the method from other models. Joyce was the primary one. That's the way Joyce writes. He writes with tremendous stylistic changes. One chapter can be in girly magazine style, and another can be in newspaper style, even with a headline treatment. He'll go from one thing to another. And when you read them, having become accustomed to it, you don't think that this is not pure Joyce. And the fact that he uses other people's styles doesn't affect the issue. That seemed to me to be a very useful model, and one that I hadn't seen used by painters. It was seeing something and then thinking, well, can it be done? And finding out that to my satisfaction, it could be done.
But I was thinking also not only of the variety of styles or quotations and pastiches and so on, but the fact that your pictures tend to be discontinuous. There are sort of gaps between the quotations, and I wonder whether you think that people are somehow filling in the gaps.
Well, there are gaps between the quotations so that they'll stay clear, so that they will be identifiable. I think it's easier to identify them if you don't mix them and confuse them too much, in the same way that each chapter of Ulysses stays clear of the others, and there's only one chapter where the stylistic changes occur within one chapter, a key chapter, which is concerned with birth of a human being and the birth of language itself. But in most cases, what you see is kept pretty clear from the rest.
The styles of most, I think the styles and therefore the message of most painting depends on a degree of assent from the audience, which is conditioned prior to the painting. For example, if you were to react rightly, as it were, to the painting of a Madonna and child, you have to know a certain amount of, you know, of Christian theology and myth. Are you expecting then a learned audience to that extent who will be able to bring to the picture this equivalent apparatus of modern mythology or Pacey religion?
Well, I've always thought that it should be possible, but it was demanding rather a lot of an audience to put together all these rather esoteric references. I don't feel it was necessary to understand all the complex references that I was making, but it would have been nice to think that somebody might have sleuthed it through.
Okay, well, shall we, what we've said, of course, haven't covered everything, so would people like to ask about anything that Richard has said?
Yes, I was surprised to find when I was reading something in the book that my political attitude was Labour, I think, non-party but vociferous. And about a week before I read that, I had joined the Labour Party for the first time in my life. And the reason that I joined the Labour Party was because I thought that Michael Foot needed support, and that if they got a few more members at a time when they were declining, it might help the situation.
I wanted to follow up. Are you still maintaining your sort of amoral position?
Yes, I would say that I still maintain the same kind of attitude, but that I have had to recognise that non-Aristotelian logic doesn't go all the way, that you can't say that everything can be subjected to the same kind of nalle attitude. And the reason is that when I look at Hitler, I say, that's bad. When I look at Margaret Thatcher, I say, that's bad. and so it goes on. I see there's good and bad in the world. War is bad. Unemployment is bad. Other things are good. People being sent food when they haven't got it is good. So there are moral judgments which can be made. These are usually political, or at least something that affects other people. If something happens which makes people unhappy, that's bad. If it makes them happy, it's good. I'm sure you understand that I can make moral judgments which are quite divorced from the kind of judgments which I would make when I say, can I produce a picture which is about the American automobile industry? And should I say that because there are certain economic and political and stylistic overtones in the American automobile industry that I shouldn't attempt to do that?
You said you did have a morality, of course. Maybe you doubt that. And that there were certain things that you found wrong. And would you find it possible for a picture to be wrong in some way, to the extent that it should not be shown?
No, only if it was deadly dull and boring.
You don't think that a painting actually could do damage? You believe, presumably, that paintings can do some good, in some very refined sense, at least. Otherwise, you, in a way, unless you were painting out of pure obsession, you wouldn't do it, or would you?
No, I can't envisage a situation where somebody would paint a picture which shouldn't be exhibited from a moral standpoint.
So you've always hold on to some transcendental values that are beyond culture, beyond politics, beyond specific kind of instance?
Yes, I think so. I do see a tremendous relevance in Duchamp's attitude to art, which he expressed very well in what he headed a general note in the Green Box. He says, always give a reason for a decision, and the tool that you will use to make that choice is ironical causality. And he goes on to say that the irony which he would use is an irony of affirmation rather than a negative irony which depends solely on laughter. I would like to believe that my paintings were ironic in that sense, an affirmative irony rather than a negative irony.
You are in the arena. You smashed up the place. I'll let you go. How soon can I expect you back here again?
Thank you. Okay, Christian, I know that while you've been over here, you've been giving a lecture about the British critical response to art in India. I wonder if you could say something about what you feel generally as the British critical response, and then perhaps more specifically, the response to this exhibition.
I forget the name of the critic, but it was about two Sundays ago in The Observer, I think it was. Howard Hodgkin's exhibition was reviewed at great length, you know, and it was a great deal of exotica was thrown into that to catch the reader's eye, and I think it misrepresents and distorts the image of India in the reader, and to that extent it's done a disservice, you know. It is not telling the truth, simple as that. I know Mr. Hodgkin's is held in very high esteem, etc., etc., you know, but be that as it may, he thinks that Howard Hodgkin's Leaves of India illuminate Indian culture. I think he doesn't do anything of the sort. He illuminates his own kind of painting, maybe. I'm not saying that it's not a legitimate exercise for Mr. Hodgkin's to pursue, you know, but to say that that Indian culture is illuminated thereby, I think that is, again, a false statement. It does not illuminate Indian culture. And the same critic, of course, hears a whole show which has its tensions, which has its anguish, if you like, because torn between two cultures, in a sense, you know. There can be many things read into it, indeed they are. But a show like that, or the first part of it, is then just dismissed in nine lines. Now, what is that show? What would that really indicate? To my mind, all that it shows is a predilection to talk up for what you know already, and to touch that which is doubtful, rather with ginger fingers, you know, gingerly. It's nervous, and you don't want to commit yourself either out of fear of hurting the Indians or the Indian sensibilities or whatever, or but it's enough also to say that you don't really know. I mean, what's so wrong with saying that?
You talked then about Howard Hodgkin and his use, perhaps, of Indian culture and Indian ideas in his own art. But it seems, looking at some of the painting in this show, that the influence from our end towards you is perhaps more from an intellectual strain in British art. I mean, for example, your own work and that of Vivan Sundaram and Nalini Malani reminds me much more of Kitai's work than Hodgkin.
I think this is a perfectly normal practice to do this, and a normal human reaction, that when you see something, you immediately see it in terms of that which you know. It happens in language, it happens in painting, happens all the time, you know, that this reminds me of so-and-so. But the implication then is that this is derivative of Kitai, is altogether an extension of the first, isn't it? And I think that is not justified. I think one would then like to know that, well, if it reminds me of Kitai, how is it different from Kitai? And what are its further implications? And why don't we then just look at it after having sort of got over the first impression of what this says? What does the picture actually say? I mean, is anybody concerned about that or not? You know, I think they ought to be, because I think a great deal of work which is upstairs, quite apart from the linguistics of painting, as it were, and any analogies with other painters, I think the things which are being spoken about and the things which are being said do refer quite specifically to rather specific situations which have existed and which are existing in India. I think there's been just too much, people are overly concerned with making painting pure, and I don't think the greatest paintings which the world has known and which have been sort of offered to the world, you know, which are the world's heritage, I do regard that too, you know, that good paintings done anywhere belong to the world. They don't belong to India or England or America or wherever, you know. And I don't think that the greatest paintings were necessarily pure. they had a lot else to give, and I do believe in this kind of a comprehensive response to a painting rather than a partial aesthetic response. I think this kind of aestheticism is a kind of a hangover, really, from the 19th century, and it was brushed up and polished up by people like Bell and Fry and so on. But I don't think we need to use that or have that as gospel either, you know. And I think painting is changing. I think certainly the paintings that you see in this particular exhibition, they will be impure. I mean, they'll have a lot in them, but I mean, a lot of which is pictorial. Pictorial doesn't necessarily mean beauty in the classical Greek sense. And if you really ask my opinion, I think that's the British hang-up still.
Vivan, there is, in a lot of the work in this part of the show, an emphasis on a realism, I suppose, an urban realism, as opposed to a pastoral, idyllic kind of mysticism. Could you say a little bit about the way that that is becoming important within contemporary Indian painting?
I think that the shift in responding to the urban environment has been, I mean, I'm not trying to make a kind of direct connection, but I think that there's some sort of general overlap in the way that the Indian bourgeoisie sees itself in transforming the society, and then it transforms itself mainly in the urban areas. That there's a new urban life or a new urban kind of consciousness which is as Indian and as authentic today as the peasant one, and it would only be part of some kind of romantic idealism to hold up the village life as the true and essential Indian way of living. And I think it's some of the younger artists have kind of gradually shifted their emphasis to the urban situation, and here you will also see in this exhibition how there's a kind of moving back and forth from, although being in an urban situation, you still have your connection or roots in a peasant society, in a very traditional society. So you today get an industrial worker in a textile mill in Bombay who would leave his family and children in some remote village, 1,500 miles away, and go back once a year, make his wife pregnant, and come back again. I mean, that, you know, and she'll go on producing children. He'll have a family there, but he'll have another life in a city because he has to come there. So there's still a very kind of close link that that the person who lives in an urban metropolis in India to his village, just as you might have often heard of the Indian who lives in London, who keeps saying, well, one day I'll go back. Maybe he'll never go back, you know. Maybe this Indian will finally, the worker will finally abandon, which is known, because he might meet a woman in Bombay, and he'll leave his family, he won't care about her. But he'll keep on saying that, finally I'll go back to my village, just as finally the Indian worker says, finally I'll go back to India and settle down. So there's this kind of spectrum of almost a kind of continuous relationship between the kind of rural, peasant, folk, mythic, to the small town and the urban. And it's in this process that that this relationship to the city, that gradually a sort of shift between a kind of lyrical romanticism, which would be in a sense the kind of dominant tendency that Indian artists would have to almost all to their lives, to their self-image as an artist, even to their works, that this kind of lyrical romanticism gradually shifts itself as it comes into a kind of urban focus to the element of a kind of more rational, more sort of self-conscious distanciation between what I'm doing and what I am and what the actual characters in the painting stand for. you have that, but that kind of overlap or tension is still very much there between the romantic, emotional and the rational. And this kind of rational and intellectual aspect is something which is sort of just being born.
Okay.